I think we ought to start a regular segment on this program called Today in Donald Trump's Economy, because that is kind of the lived reality. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 9th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know how the past 8 years or so, and before that, too, actually, every now and then I have started on a Friday with, boy, this was an interesting week in the American economy, wasn't it? Somehow I think I might be saying that a little bit more. Don't know. Either way, it's been an interesting 5 days. Lynette Lopez is here to help wrap it up. She's with Business Insider. John Carney is at the Wall Street Journal. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
What's up, Kai?
Hi, Kai.
Same old, Lynette. All right, so, John, let's start with you. Take me back to Monday, the Boeing thing, the carrier union rep president guy, and the whole Trump tweetage about that. How do you anticipate American economic policy is going to be made once he's inaugurated?
It is very, very unclear. I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like a U.S. a guy who's not even U.S. president yet, naming individual companies
and individual people, right? We all know who Chuck Jones is now.
Chuck Jones
for prez.
You know, there is a precedent for Chuck Jones. I have to say, remember the Henry Louis Gates Cambridge police officer?
Yes,
controversy. Barack Obama called out the Cambridge police on that. So there is precedent for the president getting involved. But I will have to say that didn't go over very well for Barack Obama. Right. He ended up apologizing for it. I think calling out Boeing is one thing. Calling out individual private citizens is another. Barack Obama came to regret that. I think Donald Trump will figure out that that's also not a
Do you buy that Mr. Trump is going to sort of temper his tweetage?
He's not going to temper it, but he might find that it's not – I don't think it's in his nature to have the ability to do that. What I have been seeing recently on Wall Street are people who – or research that's indicating that populism is not necessarily great for the economy. For example, Standard & Poor's recently put out a report that said, hey, maybe emerging markets are going to look just as good as developed markets if we have this populism thing and we don't have free markets anymore, because that's essentially what that means. Right. And Boeing is a perfect example of this. You know, Trump going after an individual company for its price setting instead of allowing the market to do that, you know, that creates uncertainty, the same kind of uncertainty that we see in more lefty lefty populist nations like Argentina, like Brazil. Yeah. And investors aren't as interested in those countries as they have been in developed markets. That could change us a lot.
John, can we talk for a second about stimulus in this economy? The European Central Bank came out this week and said it's going to keep on going with its economic stimulus program. President-elect Trump has promised a big infrastructure spending plan. We talked a little bit on the program today, this week, about what happens when you stimulate an already stimulated economy. Do we need a big infrastructure plan, do you think?
You know, I do think we do. While our economy, unemployment is very low, we still have a pretty high level of non-participation in the labor market. And if you look at the wages of most classes of Americans, they've been really stagnant, not just for the last couple years, but for the last 20 years. This century has seen actual real wages decline for almost every group of people who aren't in the top 5 or 1%. We need to do something different. We've tried monetary policy. Mm-hmm. We tried going to war in the Middle East. maybe actually doing fiscal policy will make a difference.
Yeah, I think investing in the American people is the thing that has been missing. I mean, the last time we did a hardcore investment in people and education and jobs was after World War II, the GI Bill, and everything that came from that, which created the American middle class. Well, ever since then, we've kind of been like, oh, let's cut some taxes.
Well, people are really excited. I get that they're excited, and I appreciate that because it's the past, you know, since the crisis, it's been rough for many, many millions of people in this country. Let me just ask you both, though, this idea of all this money coming in and the problem of inflation and, oh, my goodness, what do we do about that? And it seems almost quaint to mention it now, but the Fed raising rates. They meet next week.
Well, the question is, how do we invest this money? And I think I said this last time we were here. This has to be invested really wisely. We can't can't build things that don't matter, that aren't productive. We can't build things that are going to just cost the American people more money, like more toll roads. This actually has to be done by people who know what they're doing. And unfortunately, it seems like Donald Trump has a penchant for elevating people who are simply loyal to him, but have literally no idea what they're doing in their jobs. For example, Ben Carson, HUD secretary. Let's make him secretary of that. He's a brain surgeon. He'll figure it out.
Let's get to the economy, actually. And John, you get the last 25 seconds of this segment. And the idea that with Gary Cohn now from Goldman Sachs running the National Economic Council, it was reported today, and a bunch of very rich people in his cabinet. This is not something we are used to in this economy.
No, it's not. Although I will have to say we voted for a billionaire populist. So maybe this isn't a contradiction, but a continuation of what people voted for. As for the issues of things like inflation, we've had such low inflation for so long that even if we had a few years of pretty high inflation numbers, all that would do is bring us back to where we should be in terms of price levels. So I don't think that's a real concern. I don't think it's a concern for the Fed. I think they may raise rates a little. But there's very few signs of the economy overheating in any sense. So I'm not worried.
John Carney from The Wall Street Journal, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Thanks, you too.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
You too. On Wall Street today, can you say Dow 20K? Sure, I knew you could. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Democrats and Republicans are at loggerheads in the Senate. I should probably add again, over federal spending. The immediate focus of the agenda is a provision funding pensions for coal miners. Senators of both parties are annoyed because it only funds those pensions for a couple more months, not the rest of the fiscal year. Why? Well, because Donald Trump. Marketplace's Adam Allington explains.
Two Senate Democrats from coal country are holding up the resolution. Ohio's Sherrod Brown and Joe Manchin from West Virginia are angry the bill only funds health benefits for retired miners through April. Senator Brown says of all people, Donald Trump should seize this opportunity.
He got a lot of votes in coal country. I know that he has spoken out on Buy America issues, but he's not been engaged in helping us in either case.
There was a group of Republicans that wanted to fund the government through the end of the fiscal year, but they lost the argument, says Catherine Blakely of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
The group that wants to allow the incoming president-elect to have an impact on this current fiscal year and right now has won out.
That means the government is funded through April. That gives Donald Trump the chance to put his stamp on the government extraordinarily early. Steve Bell is a former Republican director on the Senate Budget Committee. He doesn't think this was a calculated move, that basically the Senate just punted.
So I think they chose April because it's hard to get a budget for a new president, any new president, up there by February.
Then again, this is just the warm-up act for a whole bunch of budget battles to come. Again, Catherine Blakely.
Don't forget, we also have the debt ceiling limit coming in March.
And then there's sequestration, the budget caps Republicans put into place a few years ago. Those are still binding, so there could be some friction between congressional Republicans and their president. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We and the rest of the economy are continuing to digest President-elect Trump's picks for key economic jobs. As of this morning, Trump's nominee for Secretary of Labor is Andy Puzder, the CEO of the company that owns Carl's Jr. and Hardee's. He'll be responsible for regulations covering wages and pay equity, union rights and overtime and lots of other stuff. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the primer.
Andy Puzder is a longtime critic of what he sees as burdensome government regulation that squelches job creation. Here he is on Fox News in 2014.
It's very difficult to come up with business models that justify the investment you need to make to create jobs when the government keeps increasing the expenses associated with running a business.
If confirmed, Puzder could roll back a host of Obama administration executive orders and regulations, says Rich Mangello, an employer-side lawyer at Fisher Phillips in Portland.
We would expect this next labor secretary will swing the pendulum back towards management.
And there are things Puzder could swing at right away, says Mangello, like regulations that
require greater information sharing by employers to the federal government about things like the compensation levels they give to their employees.
A bigger obstacle? The Obama administration's new rules making 4 million lower-wage managers eligible for overtime. Ross Eisenbray is with the Progressive Economic Policy Institute. He says reversing that will take
formal rulemaking, which requires doing a lot of analysis, putting out a proposed rule, accepting comments from the public.
Which Eisenbray says could take a year or more. Another wrinkle, Puzder heads a multinational fast food company right now, raising questions whether he'll have to leave that post and sever his financial ties to eliminate any perceived conflicts of interest as labor secretary. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Vienna, Austria is going to be the center of the petrochemical universe tomorrow. You might remember OPEC's already agreed on a supply cut, counting on the laws of supply and demand to bump global crude prices higher. The meeting tomorrow is to bring non-OPEC producers into that fold, including the world's biggest producer right now, Russia. If all goes according to OPEC's plan, the gathering will amount to a very public pledge to not drill. OPEC, though, would do well to trust but verify, because there is a very relevant history here of energy market cheating. From our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Officially, tomorrow's deal will cut more than 1 million barrels of oil a day from world supply. But veteran market watchers are just waiting for drillers to cheat and keep on pumping. Antoine Half at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University says Russia is a known non-complier.
In 2002, following 9/11, which caused oil demand to drop quite a bit, Russia pledged to cut production by 50,000 barrels per day. But in fact, Russia increased production by 200,000.
Several OPEC members have done this too. Economists call this free riding. We're all tempted to let others sacrifice and freeload ourselves. Jamie Webster of the Boston Consulting Group compares producers to kids. They follow the rules when everyone is watching, but pretty soon all bets are off.
In this time when many of these countries have been hit economically, you know, being able to make another easy little dollar on the backs of others is very difficult to avoid.
In a way, everyone is in on the lie. Drillers say they'll cut, wink, wink on how much. Investors pile in, they push up oil prices, and everyone makes money. Just don't trust what anyone says, says Paul Stevens at the Chatham House think tank in London.
If you know everybody's got their fingers crossed behind their back, then that obviously creates its own dynamic. We now get into sort of Kafka-esque, bizarre goings-on.
In the end, it may not be as crazy as it sounds. OPEC may still be making a directional change here to cut supply instead of add to it. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Next week, Monday to be exact, Hawaii Commercial and Sugar Company, the last of that state's sugar plantations, is going to close up shop after 145 years in business. It's the now too familiar story of ongoing losses with no end in sight in a changed global economy. But just as we were telling you yesterday about miners up in the Minnesota Iron Range, sugar in Hawaii was more than just a thing people did for work. Molly Solomon from Hawaii Public Radio was there for the final harvest.
The second you hop into Mark Lopes' truck, you know he works in the cane fields. His dashboard is covered in a layer of brown dust, and the windshield is splattered with red dirt. We drive out to Field 704, where crews set a cane fire in the early hours of the morning. By noon, much of the sugar is cleared. Lopes watches as large haul trucks get ready to head back to the mill to unload.
They'll drive right up to the windrow, they'll load the hauler, the truck will pull out. Go down to the factory and load the sugarcane.
Lopes is the harvest manager at HCNS and has been doing this most mornings for the past 35 years. He's one of 675 workers who will lose their jobs once this operation closes. Lopes is not sure what he'll be doing next.
Well, it's kind of up in the air. It's hard if you work for a company that long and then it's almost like starting over again. You know, you gotta start for another company and... And we're the last surviving sugar plantation, too, you know, so that's it for sugar in Hawaii, yeah.
Like a lot of workers at HCNS, harvesting cane runs in the family. Lopes remembers visiting his father at work in the fields.
when I was young, he used to bring me to work. I used to ride on the tractor with him and stuff, and you know, that was pretty cool, you know. And then my son, when he was young, you know, I used to bring him out on the weekends, and my granddaughter not gonna be able to experience that. So all that stuff, you know, it's gonna be missed. So it's gonna be different.
The green fields that Lopes works in every day are part of the island's landscape. Maui resident Dorothy Pyle can see all 35,000 acres of sugarcane from her back porch.
It's changing us forever because I will never see 35,000 acres of agriculture there again. It just won't happen. And so the whole feel of the island, that flying in over these fields and driving through them, never going to be again.
At its peak in the 1930s, sugar employed 50,000 people across the islands. The industry not only drew wealthy landowners to Hawaii, it also brought immigrant labor.
Actually, my ethnic heritage is what I call plantation pedigree.
That's Terry Freitas Gorman, president of the Maui Native Hawaiian Chamber of Commerce.
So I'm almost in the order that they came. I'm Chinese, Portuguese, Japanese, and then part Native Hawaiian as well.
Gorman grew up surrounded by sugarcane in the small town of Wailuku. She remembers running in the fields and hearing the crackle of cane burns at night.
We call it Maui snow, right? But the ash would fall out from the sky. And, you know, you just knew they were burning cane. It was just part of life. You didn't really question it.
She says back then, Maui was still a sleepy agricultural town. Just the smell of molasses in the air brings her back to those days.
There's a word in Brazilian Portuguese that it's called saudades, and it means kind of a bittersweet memory. It's bitter because you kind of miss it, but it's sweet because it has such wonderful feelings associated with it. So whenever I would come home to Maui from college or whatever, or after traveling, that really distinctive smell of the molasses being processed, it really created that feeling of saudades in me.
A feeling that Gorman and others in Hawaii know will now be part of the past. In Maui, I'm Molly Solomon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
She really dedicated herself to create an invention that allowed paralyzed veterans to feed themselves.
The operative word there is she, women who led the way. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 142.7 cents%, 19,756. Another record, 250 shy of that 20K mark. Look out Monday. The NASDAQ gained 27 points, 0.5%, 54.44. The S&P 500 added 13 points, almost 0.6%, 22.59. For the week, the Dow up 3.1%, the NASDAQ up 3.6%, the S&P 500, that's similar, 3.1%. When you're one of the biggest brands in the world, the change in the big boss can move markets. Coca-Cola is going to have a new CEO come May. James Quincy is his name. Shares fizzed up 2.4% today on that news. PepsiCo gained 1.3%. High-end furniture retailer Restoration Hardware said sales were slower than expected, blaming the election and the fact that their glossy catalogs were late getting into people's homes this year. Those catalogs weigh like 19 pounds, if you remember. Market was fast to move, though. Shares down 18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker.
If we want to survive, we need to change our bodies.
I never in my wildest dreams when I was teaching her how to do this thought that she would actually have to do it.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You got your seersucker for summer, maybe corduroy in the fall, depending on where you live. I'm sure there's a springtime fabric, although I can't think of it at the moment, to be honest with you. This time of year, there is probably no fabric more associated with the holiday season than velvet, which is why it's today's installment of our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Marketplace's Rima Kreis takes a look.
In LA's garment district, bolts of fabric spill out of the stores and bins of cloth line the sidewalks. At Ben Textiles, shoppers wind their way through pink lace, purple satin, red velvet. Owner Sean Yashapur, juggling a cell phone and a camouflaged walkie-talkie, flies around the shop.
Last-minute orders, last-minute events, air shipments coming in, missing weddings.
And velvet mania.
We can't keep up with the orders. It's more than tripled for us in the past 4, 5, 6 months.
Cynthia Washburn-Nestor is vice president of fashion and trend at Belk, a big department store chain across the South.
When it comes to the holidays, we think about dressing up, and velvet has always been associated with luxury.
But even by holiday standards, it's a sea of velvet out there. Velvet bags, velvet jackets, velvet booties. Melissa Moylan is a creative director at Fashion Snoops, a retail forecasting company.
It's everywhere. Designers, I know everyone from Valentino all the way down through Topshop, Zara.
She says shopping trends usually involve things, chokers, bomber jackets, ripped jeans. But this year,
velvet in itself has become a trend.
The number of new velvet products online is up by almost 200% from this November over last. That's according to Edited, a data analytics company. Kevin Jones is curator of the museum at Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising. He gets the velvet craze, but
I find in the history of fashion that velvet has never not had its moment.
Jones says the history is a little murky, but we saw a lot of velvet in Italy during the early Renaissance. It was reserved, though, for royalty, the rich. That's because velvet was made of silk by hand in a process that was super laborious and complicated.
A fabric, pretty basic, is a warp and a weft. It's a vertical and it's a horizontal fiber that just get kind of intermeshed together.
Okay. Got that.
Velvet is a supplementary material, so that means you've got that warp and weft, but then you have an extra line of material that's woven in between those two and made lofty.
For that plush feel. Or as George Costanza put it to Jerry Seinfeld,
it's so cozy, I'm ensconced in velvet. You know, if it was socially acceptable.
I know, you would drape yourself in velvet.
And thanks to mass production, he wouldn't need to be rich to afford it. Silk velvet, handmade like it was during the Renaissance, can still cost hundreds of dollars a yard. But synthetic velvet? Less than 10. And Belk's Washburn-Nestor says the fabric is becoming a lot easier to wear.
We're seeing so many new technology applied to velvet, destruction, distressing, Dave-a-ray, where, you know, you're burning out part of the velvet, so it's not as heavy, it's not as stiff, it's softer.
And there's no reason to keep it in the closet till the holidays roll around, says Simon Doonan. He's
creative ambassador at large for Barney's New York.
When I reached him by phone, he told me,
I'm wearing velvet right now. In fact, I'm always wearing velvet.
Doonan says we shouldn't be too precious about our velvet. These are casual times.
The key is just to be very throwaway about it. Don't worry if you slosh red wine or brie or any holiday morsel onto your velvet jacket.
That is, assuming you have a velvet jacket. Apparently, the velvet holiday tradition is still with us. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
We do an every now and again thing on this program about women who were trailblazers in their chosen fields. Today, a woman who was both a medical professional and an inventor. Here's author Sam Maggs.
Bessie Blount Griffin came from exceptionally difficult circumstances. She was born in 1914 with next to nothing. She attended elementary school in a one-room schoolhouse made to educate the children of former slaves. She actually dedicated her life to public service and helping others and became a volunteer nurse at a New Jersey hospital. And while she was there, she noticed that lots of veterans had lost the ability to use their limbs. And she thought it was really unfortunate that they didn't have the same kind of independence that they had before the war. And she really dedicated herself to create an invention that allowed paralyzed veterans to feed themselves using a tube that they could bite on with their teeth. Bessie's invention was hailed by the press, and she was called the Wonder Woman for her achievements in rehabilitation. Even though she had worked for so long and invested thousands of dollars of her own money into her invention, the VA wasn't super interested in paying the $100,000 that she was asking for the invention. So instead, she donated it to the French government, who used it in military hospitals countrywide. Bessie was less interested in personal fame and more determined to prove, and I quote, that as a black female, we can do more than nurse their babies and clean their toilets.
Sam Maggs is the author of the book Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed History. This final note on the way out today saw this in the New York Times. The incoming mayor of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, has a new plan to boost tourism in his city, which, it is relevant to note here, has a not insubstantial problem with street crime. The mayor wants a new tourism tax added on to airline tickets for inbound tourists, not to improve amenities or add mass transit. No, proceeds would go to reimburse visitors who get mugged. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 142 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ gained 27 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 up 13 points, almost 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.